Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk for the interfestive period, the perineum of the year. We are again in Cinnamon Hall Bar. I'm here, of course, with James Holland. How are you, Jim?
Yeah, no, not too bad. Just a very nice lunch.
Yes, good.
Better than yours, by some.
And we're joined by Jonathan Fennell.
Great friend of the show.
How are you, Jonathan?
I'm in fine form, thank you.
And writing a new book that you're...
I'm deep into the first volume of my new 3-volume history of the Second World War.
Dun, so dun, dun.
Fellowship of the Ring stage fix.
It is. Yeah. How will it all end? Yeah. The end of the world, yeah.
Well, I mean, it might end in a different way in your trilogy, because you're going beyond 1945.
Oh, Jim.
What was that?
Spoilers.
He's already starting with the spoilers.
I've already got spoilers. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
But I'm not, that's not eating a sandwich.
So I'll take it as far as China and the end of the Civil War and get some sense of how things end up in Asia after 45.
Well, and that essentially sets us up for the modern world.
Well, that's the idea. So I think Volume 3 is going to be called The New World, the war as a moment of profound change in the 20th century. So how do we set up the world that works post 45 or 49?
Well, everything changes.
And how long does it take to write a 3-volume mega history?
Oh, God help us.
Dozen years.
10 years, I'd say, yeah. So I've been going for...
So which Christmas do I want to, bags it for?
Yeah, good man. So book one. Book one.
In 2033, I would like... Yeah. Oh. The New Order, please.
Yeah. So I love, think Jim. 26 Jim for book one.
Okay.
Then add 3 for book 2.
29.
Right.
Then add 2 or maybe 3 for book 3.
Call it 32.
Yeah. Okay. So then add 10 years.
Blimey.
Then add 10 years, so 42.
Yeah.
God, something to read.
Might not be alive then.
Yeah, exactly, for when I retire.
And your next book is out in March, right?
Yeah. Out in September, got to be handed in March at some point. That deadline is sort of ever so slightly disappearing behind Monty Maiella.
Well, should we talk about writing? Here we are talking about... Where do you even begin? I mean, look, do you find you... I mean, obviously, one doesn't find one's arguments first. But the arguments presented by the material as one investigates it, of course. One doesn't go looking for proof of what one thinks. Where do you begin? Because if it's on a global scale...
Historians of war, we very rarely talk about these things, don't we? If we were writing fiction, we'd talk endlessly about our method and our approach and, you know, how we start, how we keep going, what we do when we hit a block, how we finish. And we don't do it enough, I think. So, yeah, I mean, a global war requires an immense amount of reading. Material with which I was previously not very familiar. So I've been reading a lot about China, increasingly about the war in Africa.
Sucking up to Ron Amita.
Absolutely. anything he says, I'll do. and he was helpful in pointing me in certain directions and sources I was looking for. Trying to learn about Japan. Japan is modern, complex society, not as well served.
Are you learning languages to be able to do this, or are you relying on...
I mean, obviously a fair bit of translation. I mean, I studied Latin at school for 3 years back in the day. I lived in France for years, an Erasmus scholar when I was a student, which was magnificent. So I have decent French. I can kind of navigate European language, such as Italian, and Spanish. Before I had a run-in with COVID, I was learning German, and I will get cracking at it again and kind of get it to a really workable level.
But, Duolingo, yeah, a bit more yeah, sophisticated.
Yeah, that. I mean, that kind of stuff, really, to be honest, you know, going for a run, listening to the stuff. And then, you know, I think I had a chat with Rana, actually. I said, listen, Rana, I'd like to learn Chinese so I can do this book.
And he just laughed
at me. Yeah. Like,
yeah. I remember Vikram Seth saying that he learned Mandarin so that he could better appreciate the poetry.
But he said you could learn modern Chinese and you still wouldn't be able to read the sources from the 1940s because the language has changed so much.
That's it?
Right. Yeah.
But, wow.
Yeah,
so, you never knew.
So I think you really have to be deep into it to be able to navigate that sort of stuff. Trying to grow as a historian, develop new skills.
Tons of reading.
For sure.
And then I suppose laying out what you want to investigate and then pursuing that. And I mean, because the way I wrote my last book, the way I write my current book is I sort of follow my nose. I sort of think, well, where's this going to go? What are the mechanics up to that afternoon? Because when you look at, so, the regular listener will know this. I'm writing this book about 1st Airborne Division and Poles, but only on one day at the Battle of Arnhem. So you just look at the order of battle, and it's this great long menu of, there are infantry battalions, sure, but there's a Remi set of people who go in with a mobile workshop and the spanners, and then there's the question of
Spanners descending
is the unofficial history, and you immediately you're in another world, a whole different set of considerations from the sort of fighty bit, and so I'll follow my nose on that, and that then plugs you into what the RASC people are doing and they what's happening to them
but how do you structure your notes then? So are you putting themes on it, or are you looking at it, you know, the first part of the day or the first hour of the day?
I'm breaking it down into portions of the day and in places. So I'm doing, so there's four places and four times of the day. So midnight, morning, afternoon, evening. It'll be morning, the town, the mechanic, and I'll do it like that. Or morning, the town, the doctor, and then on to morning, the town, the battalion. So that's the, so I do the doctor in 11 para, in 11 para, and then 11 para, and then the battalion beside 11 para in the place where they're fighting. So I go person, unit, place as a way of framing how I'm going to tell the story. And then the brilliant thing about, or the really interesting thing I'm finding about is that, you know, there's even in one day, there are so many meanwhiles. At 11 o'clock or at 3:30, you know, there's one thing happening one end of the village and another.
So how are these meanwhiles emerging for you then? So, you know, the criticism sometimes we get is that, you know, we impose our political beliefs in choosing these meanwhiles, the things that you think are important. Or are you able to let the sources speak for themselves?
Well, the fantastic thing about this one day and on is at 3 o'clock, literally everything you could possibly imagine going wrong for them happens all at once. There's a sort of hot hour from sort of 3 o'clock, as far as I can tell, because after all, a lot of people aren't looking at their watches when they're witnessing a lot of stuff. So there's several things that don't happen, according to some accounts, when they did, according to the official records.
Because presumably they're saying at 3 o'clock.
Oh, you've got
in the side of the war diary.
Wild discrepancies.
Yes,
so, you know,
there will be.
Urquhart escapes from his loft at 7:30 in the morning-ish. Someone reports seeing him 2.25 hours later, and he wasn't there. He's not there. The guy's looked at his watch wrong, or has not reset his watch, or
just made it up.
He's just wrong. He's just roughly.
Well, don't forget, you know, you're writing up these.
But what's really interesting is that because I'm trying to write a book about the thrust of events, I'm at the mercy of the events for the meanwhiles, rather than what I'm looking for necessarily. That, you know, that there's a moment where a Focke Wulf crashes into the church tower, and everyone knows that happens at 3:30.
But does time shorten and elongate like an accordion? So like, yep. I say there's 10 minutes for one person who could feel like 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what's going on. And you've endless time dilation and constriction and a lot of the people in the morning are like hanging around and there's not much going on. And then suddenly everything happens all at once. You know, the supply drop itself is probably only 8 minutes, but everyone, apart from one group of people in Arnhem, they see it, they watch it, they stop and watch it. They watch it happen in front of them. And all those accounts all essentially in the descriptions completely overlap. They all match up. They all see the same things. They all see the same stuff happening all at once. But one of the things I'm also trying to do is, so this Flight Lieutenant David Lord, who's in Dakota KG-334, whichever it is, or 384, goes down in flames with a wing on fire, gets a Victoria Cross, in my account, I'm not going to say he gets the Victoria Cross, because he doesn't get the Victoria Cross then. He might go in a, like post-credits thing with his VC, but I don't want it to colour the story of what happens, because there's two other aircraft that basically do the same thing, who carry on flying.
Because it's in the moment, isn't it?
It's in the moment. No one's going, oh, there's the lad with the VC. No one's saying that. They all remember him, but someone else, a couple of other planes go, the same thing happens to where they carry on flying even though they're on fire.
It's so, probably a month or 2 months or something before he gets it.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, that is an incredible art, isn't it? To try and recapture the uncertainty of the moment. Mm. We're so inclined.
It is, and I don't know if I'm succeeding. It's the God's honest truth. I'm really wrestling with this way of trying to, because what's interesting is for that event, some of the war diaries, particularly the Royal Air Force ones, are like, they are written straight away on the day. It's who's to come back. It's manifest. You know, every single person that went on all the flights. And, you know, there's one flight where there's a bloke from the Fleet Air Arm who hitches the lift, and then he's shot down, and he's in a plane that's shot down. He's killed. He doesn't have a parachute because he's hitched the lift. He's gone to watch. The RAF diaries are all written that afternoon when everyone gets back, whereas a lot of the Army ones were written up a lot later.
I've got to say, I'm a complete convert to the kind of in the moment thing. It's different if you're doing a sort of really big sweep. Generally, you can't possibly do that. But I think if you're doing a kind of like a shorter frame, which is sort of what I seem to be doing, I know January to June, which is the beginning of June, it's effectively 5 months. Basically, doing kind of 3 to 5 months periods for the books I'm doing at the moment, and I think that enables you to write it absolutely in the moment and using primarily contemporary sources, original sources. So this is diaries, letters, memos, stuff.
In his last book, you know, there's the there are these diaries, and there's an absolute gut punch where one of the, you think it's a diary that must have been published after the war or whatever, and it's one that was found on the dead guy.
Oh my God, there's even more than this one.
Well, yeah,
people are always constantly dying.
but that puts you into the reality of it as a you know, and it's a German guy in the flat unit, isn't he? He dies in the.
He's a reconnaissance unit. Yeah,
that's right.
And if you don't know, then the world looks really different. I mean, I was reading the diary of a profound anti-fascist in Italy in the early 20s, and he's getting to grips with Mussolini's, assumption to power. Yeah. And in the first month, he says, Mussolini sounded like a dictator, but in the period after that, maybe he will stick to the Italian constitution. Maybe actually he'll be able to get a grip on the kind of wilder elements of the fascist movement. Maybe it'll be okay. And so he's not sure.
But we're all saying that about Trump and things at the moment.
Yeah. That's exactly what I thought of. I thought, you know, here we go thinking, oh, maybe we can control.
Maybe a second term will be okay.
Maybe he'll be constrained. And maybe he will. It's the other thing is, because we don't know. There's no way, and there's no way of knowing. One of the difficult, really hard things is to put back in, you know, especially around such a well-trod event as the Second World War, is how to make it feel like. We often talk about, you know, it's a foregone conclusion. If you're an economic historian, if you're a Marxist historian, you approach this foregone conclusion that the Germans are going to lose the Second World War, just on the raw numbers of what they've taken on in terms of three imperiums eventually by late 1941. Foregone conclusion, but no one's thinking that.
We should never use that term, should we? As historians, I mean, we have to believe in the agency of leaders, ordinary people.
Yep.
Things can change at the drop of a hat.
Weather.
Weather.
Leave people out of it.
Yes, and I'm thrilled to say that chapter one of my casino book is going to be called The Storm. That's how the 1944 is met, is this enormous storm, and it's just absolute carnage everywhere. You know, all the Fodger airfields are flooded, tents are being ripped up, there's carnage, there's sort of vehicles over, you know, turned over and so on. It's absolute nightmare.
So what's your process then? I mean, do you start with notes? Do you do it thematically?
God, I still haven't quite kind of mastered the kind of the perfect. With me, there's always a kind of like a seed. There's always something that gets me into the subject, some event, some thing that I kind of think, oh yeah, that's an entry point. What I do is I reckon there's four stages. So I think the first stage is hunter gatherer. And that's where you go off and do all your kind of archival work. And you're trying to get your... What I absolutely don't do is read secondary sources at all at this stage. So, I mean, something like Casino, the Italian event, I already know what's going on. So I know the kind of the big fence posts. So I don't need to read book that was written kind of 15 years ago about this, because I've sort of, you know, I've already got that.
How did you acquire that, Jim?
Well, just over the years. I mean, but you have as well. You'd have a pretty good sense of the main events and stuff.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, when the main battle is, you could check up all this stuff on it. So what I do is I go off and I hunt and I go to archives and I gather stuff. And I've got to say, the first port of call is getting, because I have a different way to a lot of historians, and I have a very specific cast list of characters who are my human drama to be the conduit for that through the narrative. And that gives you the scope to then do the analysis and the kind of, you know, the kind of sort of slightly kind of more weighty stuff. But you have to have the right cast list. So you have to, you know, I always do kind of 4 or 5 times the number of people that I need to. So you have to go out and get these diaries. You have to go and look at them all, and you have to work it out. And then you need to read around it. So today, for example, I was looking at this. Everyone at Fifth Army is having an absolute fit because this message has come back from George Marshall over in Washington going, how the hell did this get past censors? So it's a war correspondent who's come in and gone, situation in Italy is an absolute shower. All the guys, you know, the Sherman tanks are rubbish compared to Tigers. The men are exhausted. Some of our units have been in the line for 110 days. This is not good enough. It's a pretty gloomy picture, this, but I want it to be because this is not good enough. And Marshall has gone back to Fifth Army and gone, how the hell did this get through? So there's this internal investigation within Fifth Army headquarters going, what the heck? This has never have got out. So I've then immediately said, okay, so who wrote this piece? So I found out who the guy who's writing it. He's a journalist. Of course he's written stuff after the war. Of course he wrote a memoir. Of course he's published his diaries. So quickly get onto ABE, buy the diaries. They'll be here in my house in a few days' time. He'll be another character, so I can get him doing it. Then I can have the aftermath of this article. And it'll all... be absolutely amazed if it's not featured in his diary.
So there's a theoretical underpinning to that approach, right? Which is people matter. Is that your fundamental?
Yes. Yeah. So I get my cast list. Then I kind of read around it with original documents, and then I might do some secondary reading, because then I kind of think, oh, I need to know a bit more about, you know, this is an interesting thread, this whole morale. Oh, well, yeah, Jonathan's book, yeah. Flip through that, you know, People's War, yeah. You know, well thumbed on my bookshelf. And, you know, and so you kind of sort of start building a picture. So there's hunter-gatherer. Then I come home and I kind of marshal it all, and I kind of think, okay, I've got it all now. I now need to read through it all. So then that's a process and a half. And what I do is I create a chronology. So I have a timeline, and I have main events in just ordinary font. Yeah. And then I have then I have big events in bold, bombing the monastery, for example. Yeah. Then I have color coordinated for nationality. So Germans are purple, Americans are maroon, Italians and French are green.
Why the Italians are French? You've got to explain these colors.
British are blue. Okay. British and Duke forces.
Not pink or red, or
is anyone red?
Yeah, Americans are red. That's sort of maroony red.
Okay, right.
But it's also what's on my kind of easy font on kind of.
What, and then you can glance along it.
So what I then do is say you know, Laurie Franklin Vale pissed off about such and such at this on this day. Right. You know, this is his letter where he says this. So that tells me that. So suddenly, and you add to this all the time. So at the end of it, you've got this chronology which tells you the skeleton of the book. And so I then now know that on this day, I've got to, you know, I've got this big event, but I can also fold in Wilhelm Mauss. I can fold in Jörg Zellner. I can do something that Mark Clark's cross about. I can do Laurie Franklin Vale and Hissick. And you kind of sort of fold it all in. Not everything goes in, obviously. So that's your ducks in a row. Then there's just writing the bastard, which is just kind of by that point, I'm ready to go. I'm just like up at 6 every day. I'm at my desk by 6:15. I just pound it all day until I've done it with dog walks and coffee breaks.
So will you write all the way till when? To what time?
8, 9.
So you can go. That's
yeah,
a, that's
yeah. But I mean, yeah. You know, I'm not writing solidly the whole time, but I'm powering.
And what's a good word count for you on a good day?
4.
Cripes.
I wrote four the other day.
Then
I need to lie down the following day.
then the fourth stage is after you've written it, which is a bit I always forget about, which is when you're trying to organize your maps and photos and proofreading and all that. And that's the bit where you're just utterly fed up the whole thing, don't want to ever read it again, look at it, and suddenly lost all interest.
You know, so one of your great skills is the ability to tell stories and to make these complex ideas accessible to people, right? By viewing them through the experience of ordinary people. So do you have then kind of subheadings within your process that kind of says, ah, well, this guy is great on, okay, morale or command or, yeah.
Yeah, so what I'm getting for this book is what I don't have, is I don't have really good eyewitness accounts of the 34th Red Bulls on Snakehead Ridge. I don't have really good accounts Punjabs on Monte Cassino because they all died or were wounded or went back to India and didn't keep a record. So they just don't exist. So I'm not going to beat myself up about that. I will obviously explain what happens, but the war in Italy will be seen through the eyes of the characters that I do have. And one of the things that's come across so strongly, and more so than ever before, even more so than when I was doing the first bit of the Italy campaign, is the landscape and the conditions and the environment and the mood and the kind of falling morale and the battle exhaustion, because it just makes so much more sense looking at Anzio and Cassino and everything when you realise what these guys have already been through since Sicily.
I mean, to be tangential about that, and that's the fridge in the bar we're in, by the way, if you're listening. The new gallery, the Blavatnik Gallery, the bit of film they've got about battle exhaustion, combat fatigue, is from Italy. They've got, it's amazing, isn't it? They're absolutely extraordinary. They've got eight minutes of filming some casualty clearing station or psychiatric casualty clearing place, and they've got no sound in it. So, I mean, what they really need is a lip reader to go in, and because it's these blokes being interviewed at the, you know, at the place where you're sedated and then rested up and given a fresh set of battle dress and new underwear or whatever and a couple of square meals and then patted on the back and sent back, and they've got film of it, but it's from Italy, and that was the really, really interesting thing. And immediately when I was watching, immediately made me think of you and talking about morale in Italy.
So I think with this book, I'm going to try to put the landscape quite first and foremost on the Savage Storm, but even more so with this. I'm getting so much mood, and I'm what I'm trying to do is really convey what people are thinking about this at the time, whether they be an Italian civilian, whether they be a monk in the monastery, whether they be German, whether they be whatever they are. And I've just come across these amazing kind of diaries and letters from a guy called John Strick. John Strick actually ended up having a post-war volume of poetry published by Harold Nicholson. He was in correspondence with him. He was an aspiring writer. His father was a major general in the First World War. Anyway, he writes this diary, and the first London Irish, he is intelligence officer, but he also runs a thing called X-Platoon, which is like a special patrol, aggressive fighting patrol. I mean, he has these hardcore people that go with him and they do aggressive patrol work. And anyway, he's on this patrol and it all goes horribly wrong and he gets injured. Afterwards, he's writing up his diary in hospital, and he's so reflective, and he writes a whole episode of what happens and his regret. And he keeps saying, I just kept bursting into tears, and I just couldn't go on, and I got picked up. And then afterwards, he has a kind of week's convalescence after he's recovered, where he's sort of going to Pompeii, he's meeting up with people, and he's going out for dinner, and he's just chilling out, and he goes on a big walk up to some castle, all the children kind of pester him the whole time, and he's just constantly kind of talking about life, where he's at, what he thinks. Suddenly it's time for him to rejoin the unit again, and he starts getting very reflective and anxious about it, and says, I don't really think I'm ready for this, but I've got to do it anyway. And of course he goes into Anzio and is, you know, spoiler alert, blown to smithereens. But it is incredible, because his character, he's a bit of a fusspot. He's weirdly sort of delicate of stomach. You know, I ate this food last night, I've had terrible indigestion all night. It's like, oh, come on. You know, you're in Italy, mate. His character just really comes across really quickly. And this is the thing, the best diaries, the best letters, the character, whether it be a grunt on the bottom of a chain or someone a bit higher up, the characters really ooze off the page. And you really get to know them. They're absolutely living, breathing, full color 3D people. They're not black and white figures. They're not two dimensional. They're not some old bloke with outsized ears talking about his memories kind of 70 years on. These people are absolutely the person they are on the day that they're writing about this. And it's incredibly vivid. And it's profoundly upsetting when they then get killed or wounded or injured, and their grief about other people. Also, lots of very weird relationships. So he has a very, very intense relationship with his Batman. It's not sexual, clearly, but there is an intensity to it, born out of camaraderie, out of mutual trust. They are completely interdependent on each other. And both of them, he and the guy, his Batman, writes to his mother afterwards and just goes, I'm totally heartbroken. I don't know what I'm going to do. I don't know how I'm going to survive this war without him. And he says in his diary, I don't know how I'm going to survive with Jock if anything happens to him. And it's not sexual. It's a kind of mutual, total interdependency on it. And the other guy gets killed as well. I mean, after my story. But I mean, it's very powerful stuff. And it takes you, I think, much closer to the reality of what it was like than just going, this brigade came up and they got blown to pieces and, you know, the guns opened fire and all the rest of it. It's too distancing all that.
But all the great theory on war says that this stuff really matters. I mean, go away and read On War by Karl von Clausewitz.
Yes.
And he says, you know, it's really an awful lot about morale and willingness and dirt and the awfulness, and how do you get people to do things in those contexts? I mean, if you're at the bottom of a hill in Italy and you've got to get to the top of the hill and you've got a gippy tummy, it's a very different prospect, right?
Yes, and there's this guy, okay. There's this guy who's after, so the storm on the 31st of December, the next day they wake up and they're just the whole place is totally flooded and they can only get out of their tent and to clear, because the tent's on a slight rise, by going through this lake. And he said, I was in absolute agony. The water was so cold. It's like absolute physical pain. So it's not pain from being shot in the guts or...
But it's being outdoors.
It's just being outdoors
and you just think, which is the thing. Bloody hell. I remember two war fests ago, I said to you, it's just striking me how this is... You're outdoors all the time. We are not used to being outdoors all the time. These people are literally living...
Female nurse saying, I haven't had a bath in 6 months and 2 weeks.
Oh, God. And that is the moment on which we will take a break while you toy with that image in your mind. Of a dirty nurse.
Okay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to We Have Ways to Make You Talk. We're in the Butteritz in Edmund Hall in Oxford, talking to Jonathan Fennell. And where have we got to?
Well, we got to your process. So presumably your process is, Jonathan, you've got, I mean, for such a big sweep like this, where you're covering
everything,
sort of 18, 17 years, that's, I mean, you're going to have some primary sources, but that's got to be a lot of secondary sources, isn't it? I mean, unavoidable.
So I have to lean on secondary sources. And so my process is I go through those. I'm trying to pull out what I see as key themes, and then I use, you know, document map paint, not to get too kind of technical on Word, and kind of highlight those.
How do you do that? What is document mapping?
It's the best thing.
Okay, I think I need to do this.
So tell me, with a navigation pane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's what I do.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah,
Jim, yeah. I don't know this.
Jim,
what?
So you can have titles down the side and the titles beneath them and subtitles, and then drop into them. So I've laid out the structure of my book.
Boom.
And then you.
What is this?
So you can. So
this
you
new
can,
language you speak.
So basically, you can go to the end of the book and write the end of the book, and it's in place within the within the shape of the book if you want.
Ah, but I have to use primary sources as well. I have to. If I'm going to bring something different.
You've got a lot, though, haven't you?
I have a lot. And so I've had research assistants. I've gone to archives in America myself, sent people to and had help in Italy and Germany and elsewhere in China. And so I think, you know, at this stage, you know, I can't go and look at everything.
But if you're looking for a Chinese archive, do you go to the Chinese government and say, I'm here to write about China in the Second World War, from a British perspective, or what you understand, or an Irish perspective, but like from a global post, whatever your perspective is, you're pitching to them. How do you do that? What are they telling? What are they prepared to tell us?
Research assistants at this stage who can navigate these systems. I mean, what's really frustrating?
So you've got one in China, have you?
I've got help and.
Need a permanent research assistant. That's what I need.
But then, what can we do about the Soviet Union, Russia? I mean, So the sources I want that are probably in Moscow or whatever, they will be. How does one get one's hand on them at the moment?
Well,
and that's a challenge.
Ian McGregor, you know, he had that whole thing in Stalingrad, didn't he, where he made friends with the people at the museum in Stalingrad and got hold of those exercise books because people were asked to, in the early 50s, were asked to write down their reminiscences. So he got his hands on all that, but that's gone.
Well, I mean, some of the stories I've heard from colleagues who've managed to pull off research in Russia over the last decades, I mean, it's not standard archival work. I mean, it's not just you rock up. There's all sorts of shenanigans and fun.
And they might not want you to come back if you write the wrong thing, right?
Have you still got all those German morale reports and things?
Yeah, I've got some of those.
Can you share any of those?
Of course.
Italy?
Yeah. there's none for Italy that I've been able to find yet. So I'm trying to find those. Loads on the Eastern Front.
And what if there's a gap in the record? When you draw a blank, what do you do?
What do you do? You go back. You dig and you go further into the archives and see what you can find. I don't know how you approach it. I mean, there's historical imagination. You've got to try to find ways to make sense of it.
Yeah.
One of the tools I'm trying to use is a little bit like you, Jim. I'm trying to follow kind of families through the war as a sense to make personal these big ideas, these kind of concepts that I want to drive the story.
Yep.
And so let's say where I couldn't find censorship reports or morale reports, then I might try and find a family, lean on the secondary sources to say, well, this is the state of collective mood at this point.
Yep.
And then make it real by digging into a family's experience. So yeah,
there are all these places that you think there aren't. I mean, in German, there are loads and loads of German records. You just got to find them. So there's tons of stuff I'm trying to find, which I know that the sources exist for Casino, and I know what their names are, but I just can't find them around.
But secondary sources can also be really useful in what they leave out and the picture they're trying to paint post the event, after the fact justifications that people engage in and all that sort of stuff. And you need to be able to read between the lines of the secondary source as often as not. Sort of treat almost as a piece of literature and say, what's the author trying to tell me here about the event I'm trying to investigate? I mean, I think especially with memoirs, the thing I love, for instance, about Montgomery's memoir, for instance, is it tells you everything about the man. If you want to know what he was like, if you want as clear a picture of what a piece of work he was, you read his book about himself. There's no need to read a book about Montgomery by someone going, oh, he's an awful prig and he thought he was right about everything and he wouldn't accept responsibility for this, that, and the other, because that's what his memoir's like. If you want to, you know, he's like giving himself the worst character reference imaginable in his memoir. And I've a lot of time for that, in a way. The excuses people make speak to character too, you know, and I think that's what's interesting about particularly secondary source. Memoirs, after all, occupy a sort of, they're half primary, half secondary, I think, you know, especially the further away from the event or the bigger the clangor that the person who wrote the memoir made, you know, they occupy sort of half space.
So do you employ a rule on that? Will you only use memoirs if they're written a particular length of time after the event?
Well, what I'm trying to do with this now, I'm trying to make myself an 80% rule. So that 80% is completely contemporary. I think a memoir, if it's very obviously based on the diary they wrote in the war, but not written until 2002, I think is fine. As long as it's based on contemporary stuff and it's got that kind of, I mean, listen, we've read so many of these things now. You can tell when it's bullshit and when it's kind of made up. And yeah. I mean, I've read so many memoirs that are sort of self-published or kind of published by some kind of out of the way place and total bollocks from start to finish. You know, it's just been massively kind of exaggerated and sort of filled in by the kind of the ghostwriter, and it just doesn't ring true, you know. And so I think you have to use personal judgment. But I mean, you know, I'm not writing academic work, so I think it's sort of Well, you know, I mean, I've just been listening to my brother and Dominic's thing on the Aztecs, where the whole thing is based on...
No one knows a thing about it. It's like any Roman history.
Moctezuma could have died this way, or this way, or another way, or another way. Yeah. And no one knows. And this is all based on kind of hearsay and what people are saying.
And was that even his name?
And they weren't even called Aztecs.
Yeah.
But so, you know, I think it's okay. But I think, you know, one has to, you know, when you're writing for the wider general public, you've got to have kind of obviously deep pride in what you're doing, and you've got to impose your own academic rigor onto this, and because you're not being judged on your peers in an arcane academic journal. You know, there's an awful lot taken on trust, but I think you have to earn that trust, and I think you've got to be true to yourself without wanting to sound too wanky, and you've got a pretty high standards, and I just don't think you can write anything that you don't know to be true or have a pretty good idea to be true.
There has to be an honesty, doesn't there?
There has to be an honesty. You can't just make stuff up.
And there has to be emotional intelligence, I think, as well. I mean, to imagine what it must have been like to look at up the top of the hill in Italy, from the bottom of the hill in Italy, with a sick stomach.
But you can also have a photograph, which is, after all, a moment in time captured, and you can see people trudging up a hill, and there's nothing to stop you describing what I'm saying. So, you know, the platoon was heading up the mountain, the donkeys with head, you know, the mules with their laden down, you know, the peak was 3,000 foot further up and a stony path and all the rest of it. You're just describing what you're seeing in that photo. You know, that's perfectly true, but you're putting a kind of, you know, you're trying to write it in a way that is easy to read, is compelling, takes people kind of as close as you can possibly get to that moment, all those sort of things.
Do you get it right first time?
My process is I write my chapter, then I stop, read it through, edit it then, and then basically never look at it again until the copy editor comes back.
Okay, so you get it pretty right first time. I mean, I'm on the sixth version of my first chapter, whereas because I'm trying to do global history, and I was trying, you know,
it's tricky.
I wasn't able to get, well, here are the key themes. So I had to write each country independently, which of course read awful, right? I mean, it's just too much. And then I wrote it again, trying to bring it all together and see the patterns across. And so it's just this layering process of one step after another. I'd love to have been able to get it right first time, though.
The further I get into the thing I'm writing, the easier it comes. And then I have to go back to the beginning and rewrite the first thing I wrote to make it tally with the way the book's kind of ended up. The style has ended up. So it's sort of, you know, I've only written one history book so far.
And well, so, helped so get it pretty
discovering,
nicely.
Discovering the prose style, discovering my house style. The thing I found really, really difficult about writing Command was I've published five comedy books, right? Three of which I had a couple of other guys writing on it with me, and I'd say you go write that bit. And then I'd rewrite it all. So it had all gone through me. But basically, all right, you've got that right. That'll go. That can go in. And these are the jokes and all this sort of thing. But what you don't have is someone going, I need a source for that. Where did that come from? I'm not sure you've got. Is that right? You know, don't you mean this? You know, all this sort of stuff. Because it's sort of. I tend to write in a sort of it's like a stew. You know, the things get thrown in, and then on the edit they get tidied up. But for you write five comedy books, the only arguments you can ever have is they go, I'm not sure this is funny. You go, well, I am, right? And it's my name on the cover. So this is going in the book, right? So it's like an alien process. And also I've got the voice I have for the pub landlord character very well thrashed out, very well worked out. The margins, where the edges are, you know, we don't go outside that, and this is how we write for it, and this is the tone, the editorial, basically. It's been worked out for a long time. So I can, with confidence, hire other people to write to it, and then if they get it wrong, tell them they've got it wrong and fix it. But when I was writing for a history book, for the first time, for myself or for my reader or for who, you know, first of all, you're figuring that I'm writing a book I'm interested in, or I think other people might be interested in. My approach to that was with my stand-up. I've always tried to write stand-up shows that I would enjoy watching, because that's the only person I can really be certain of in that regard. And it just so happens other people find it funny. So that's good. So, you know, So far, so good in that regard. But for the history, it's like, well, okay, how do I, what even am I going to, how does this work? Do I go rabbit, sort of down the rabbit hole thing? Do I do the diversions in order to make other points? Very quickly adhered to that idea, because that's what I'm interested in. I'm interested in where does someone use one thing to tell a story about something else, or something else to tell the story about the original thing? You know, like, how do we, which is why my first chapter is about syphilis, venereal disease, and Montgomery.
Yeah, yeah,
you know,
I love that, yeah.
Because how on earth do you put those two things together? Well, you know, he's a product of the 19th century. Syphilis is the spectre that's stalking Europe in the 19th century as much as anything else. And so it felt like that felt like to me the way to go ahead. But I really had to sort of figure that out. And then by the end of writing the book, there's the chapter about Percy Hobart in the book where basically my editor said, could you do one more, guy? And I wrote that in a week. I went, I know what I'm looking for. I know where I'm going to get it. I know which bits to pick together. I know what my argument is. And that chapter I was able to, basically, I wrote that, half of that in a hotel in Swaffham, the other half in a hotel in Leeds. I just like pumped it out because I knew what the book was about by then. And I found that really, once I reached that point, I found that really exciting as a way of, and I almost feel if he'd given me the time, do me two more, I'd have been able to pick two more and pack it, deliver them like that.
But you might agree. I mean, I think that seemed a pretty grown-up book, didn't you?
I liked it, yeah. I thought it was an excellent.
It really romped along. It was serious. I mean, there was no way that you would ever doubt that you're not a serious historian from that.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, you keep saying this, Jim, and I still don't believe it. But it felt like using people to tell an arc, and there are no battles in it. Well, not really, which I was quite pleased about, because sometimes some battles I'm interested in, others like, I can't do this again. That you know, up go the buffs or whatever, and they're late to their start line. I can't do this again. You know, but what's going on? What's motivating them? How have they arrived at this way of doing things? That feels to me like you're putting the ghost into the machine again, which again brings us back to the people and attitudes and what's motivating people, I think is so interesting, because it's the question you'd ask about yourself. You know, what would I do, or how would I be motivated?
But I was talking to some of the boys at We Have Ways in September, and some of them they're interested in, they wanted to do some writing. And they wanted to produce podcasts and all sorts of stuff. Yeah. And they were saying, like, how do you get into it? What do you do? And I think what you've just said there is really powerful, which is kind of follow your instinct, follow your interest. And if you follow your instinct and your interest, you'll do it well. And if you do it well, you're more likely to be successful.
Weirdly, this is going to sound, to me, this makes complete sense. In comedy, there's this rule that the parochials are universal, right? The reason Victoria Wood is very, very funny is because she talks about minute details of stuff. And we all have minute details in our life, and that's how we relate to what she's talking about. Or you know, you look at the Alan Bennett Talking Heads, famous for the fact that they're about very small lives. We all live our own small life, so there's a way the parochial becomes the universal. The things that concern us universally are the things that concern us directly and intimately. So one of the things I always thought, with people say to me, oh, your act's really, really British. I think, well, why are Australians laughing at it then when I go to Australia? Why do people in New Zealand find it funny? Why can I go to Hong Kong and play there and a complete cross-section of people find it? Why did it work when I went to Montreal? And it's because, you know, the parochialism of the sort of patriotism that the pub landlord expresses and the parochialism of man who thinks he has the answer to everything, solution to everything, that's a universal trait. And that's why, you know, the truth is that there are, I in my experience, there are no core or when I go to Ireland, they get what I'm doing. There are no core ideas of national cultural ideas of what's funny. That they're human ideas. That there are core things that make everyone laugh one way or another. And so the parochial is the universal. And if you write history like that, you know,
I think that's really, really interesting, because I was sort of thinking, God, there's so much detail in some of this John Strick diary. It's the detail that's making him come alive as a personality. The fact that he's kind of worrying about his, you know, the spaghetti he's been eating. Again,
so,
it's kind of it's,
so by that token. So if the thing you're really interested in is, you know, and it's a point I made at the start of my book. You know, what is a truck? What is a truck? It's a thing designed by people. So what were their lives like? It's a thing built by people. So what were their lives like? Thing that breaks down. What's it like for the mechanic when it breaks down? Where it breaks down? What, you know, how do you change a tire in it? Any object has a thousand stories pinging out of it immediately, and every story is a person.
Yeah, I think as historians, we're fundamentally students of human nature. Yeah. And it sounds like a comedian is a student of human nature.
Well, what you're doing is you're playing with it and talking about it and interacting with it. That the parochial could be the parochial is one way in. It's why people who do observational comedy talk about Jesus Christ, when you get to the top of the escalator and there's someone stood there and they don't know whether they've stopped at the top, what are they doing? We can all relate to that tiny parochial moment, but it's one that happens to all of us. I mean, it's the really, really interesting thing about the pandemic was, and this really chimed with the thing Dennis Norden said. So Dennis Norden got his start in comedy, writing comedy with Frank Muir after the Second World War. And he said, the brilliant thing about 3 years after the Second World War is if you mentioned rationing, everyone knew what you were talking about. You didn't have to set out your stall at all in communicating with an audience because everyone had the same things in common. And so the year before last, this lasted until just in the autumn of last year, if you talked about anything pandemic related, everyone knew exactly what you were talking about. They may have had a different view of it all. So we had this weird universal parochial moment where we were all bound together by this thing that intruded right into our lives. And of course, the Second World War is one of those events that intrudes right into everyone's lives without any choice.
One of the things I've been really trying to do is trying to work out, you know, is there a fourth wall on writing these books? Is there sort of a way of doing it that hasn't been done yet? And I've been thinking quite a lot about form. One of the things I've really tried to do with the book on the Sherwood Rangers and more recently the Italy book is trying to play with the prose a bit more and not just write it straight with a consistency. So what I've been doing is, you know, if I am describing any kind of battle scenes or combat, then much shorter sentences, slipping into the first person, not first person, into the present tense, and then slipping out again. And then, you know, when you're doing descriptions of landscape and stuff, a bit more languid, a bit more sort of, you know, florid in the writing, and trying to sort of think about that, because what is it that makes someone kind of read on? What is it that makes writing compelling?
Jokes.
Yeah, but you know, it's just not that funny in Italy. That's the problem. So, you know, I think that's really interesting, and I think also the thing about that, if one does think in these sort of terms, then I think. And it sounds like you're having quite a lot of these kind of moments out when you're sort of thinking, okay, how do I do this out? How do I do this where I'm kind of serious, but I'm also got my own voice, and you know, you're writing so that it's compelling and that people want to read on and stuff. I think it's good to constantly be thinking that and questioning about yourself, because I think the terrible thing is to become complacent. You never want to take any of this stuff for granted. You never want to kind of presume about your audience either. You always want to kind of sort of keep it fresh and get better, I think.
Find that rhythm. Yeah, and I'm trying to make this a beautiful book. And I'm learning every day about just what length should the sentences be? How do we find, to what extent can I use these characters, these families as a tool to tell stories? Mm-hmm. And it is different from a hard academic book that one might write. And it comes back to, I think, presenting it through the eyes of ordinary human beings. Being a storyteller, being a student of the human experience. And I think if you can, that is kind of philosophical, I think. I think, you know, we're all sharing here a perspective, and maybe it's politically driven, I do not know, but that it's one thing to understand, say, the policy that Hitler was putting in place. It's another thing to understand why people followed those policies.
But I mean, it's really interesting that, I mean, human agency in history for a long time was sort of unfashionable, wasn't it? And so it is interesting that you say, is this a political point of view? Because after all, that's the Marxist thrust of his history, is that human agency is kind of like, why bother talking about it? It's sort of absent in a strange way from events. Yet do you think this is a political position to hold, that human agency matters? Or do you just think it makes sense that's what the world's really like? Because to some people, it is a purely political statement to say that agency matters.
I don't think it's a political statement, although I can see why some would say this is a very Marxist perspective.
Yeah.
But then a scientist might come in and do a cohort study that would look at groups of people and how those people experienced a certain reality. And we wouldn't blink twice about making generalizations about what certain groups of people think.
Yeah.
We're not saying that their perspectives and ideas are determined by their social class or by their region, but we're saying people can have similar experiences and that can create political views or attitudes. So I think there is a way that we can do it without falling into that trap. I certainly haven't trying to, I'm not trying to approach this book as a political tool. I've no interest in that whatsoever.
Yeah. I mean, there are people who don't like Marxism who might jump on that though and go, you see, Marxist history is done for because people are writing books that don't, you know, aren't long, because you can't write the thing. I mean, I think this is one of the reasons actually why, you know, war, what, there's so much contingency in war and agency and all those sort of things that actually very often why historians on the left avoid it, because it's kind of treads on an awful lot. You know, you think of the Battle of Midway, that someone popping through a cloud and spotting the Japanese fleet, even if it's blind luck, that's a human's blind luck, that gap in the cloud, and the weather isn't concerned, the weather's its own long durée of its own unfathomable nature in the end, I suppose.
The human condition is so complex, it's infinitely complex.
Yeah.
And so to try and put any framework to explain the whole thing is, I think it is beyond us. The best we can do is just ride the wave, right? Try and work it out in any particular circumstance.
We're getting deep. This is very deep, Jim.
So I'm thinking about that Spinal Tap quote where he goes, standing behind Elvis's grave. Yeah,
too much perspective. Too much perspective. Too much fucking perspective. well, we hope you've enjoyed this.
I mean, that's a way to end a Spinal Tap quote, isn't
the
it?
The thing is, we're in a bar and there's no drink yet. We're talking like, we're talking like huddled round pints.
That's been great. It's been really good fun.
Jonathan, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah,
thanks everyone for listening. We'll see you all again in 2024.
Cheerio.